Okay, this is Bill Blatchford. Welcome to this night's conference call. This is Bill Blatchford, and tonight we have with us our guests, Dr. Ira Shapira and Mark Amade of Chicago. Before we get started tonight, I want to thank all of you for being on this call. I know it's a great summer evening, at least it is where I am. I'm in Friday Harbor, Washington, on my boat, and looking at the weather map of the United States, it looks like it's pretty nice all over. So I appreciate you all taking some time out to be on this call. I especially appreciate Dr. Shapira and Dr. Amade for their giving up their part of their evening here this evening. 6:30 here on the West Coast, so I think we're 9:30 on the East Coast, so I'd like to get started. One of the things that always happens, we do these A-book calls on a regular basis, and tonight we have over 40 doctors registered on this call. There were 15 on the call when I came on, so there'll be more joining us, I presume, as we get going. But question always comes up is, how do you create a practice that is successful year in and year out? How do you keep a practice going? Now, Dr. Shapira and Dr. Amade, I'm going to let them tell their whole history. We've been working together now for several years. But following the level of thinking that they were doing, just like everyone else, I'm wondering why the results don't improve. And one of my favorite people in the world is Albert Einstein. And one of the quotes that he gave was, is that you cannot solve a problem using the same level of thinking that you use to create the problem. I'm working with a coach, Dan Sullivan, who works with entrepreneurs, and Dan Sullivan calls it feeling of complexity, that everything that we do, using our knowledge, our background, we hit a ceiling of complexity. In other words, we've done everything that we know how to take a situation and make it better. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's your practice, your level of physical fitness. And I think that's a good example. In March, for my birthday present, my wife gave me a ride on the Olympic bobsled run in Park City, Utah. And I had a compression fracture of L4 as a result of it. Now, since I've healed, and wearing a brace for 8 weeks was real simple compared to what some people have, so I feel real fortunate. I've been working out with a personal trainer and a physical therapist. And it's real interesting. The reason I got the compression fracture in the first place is not because it was a high G turn. It was. It was 5 Gs, and I've done that in airplanes before. But it was an abrupt 5G turn. But the bottom line was, I had a very weak core. Now, even though I go to a gym probably 4 times a week and work out, I do the same exact thing every time. I get on the treadmill or the Stairmaster or one of the elliptical trainers, and I put in 30 to 40 minutes on that, get my heart rate up there, and I target 120 beats per minute and keep it up there. So cardiovascular, I'm doing okay. And then, like every other man, I go to the weight part of the gym, and I start lifting weights, and I work on arms, shoulders, legs, and that's what I do. I just kept doing that. I've done that for years. And yet, as soon as I started working with a personal trainer, he ran me through a few tests to find out my core was extremely weak. He was actually very surprised to find out how little muscle tone I actually had in the center of my body. I mean, the obliques, the abdominal muscles, the back muscles. And this is, again, a feeling of complexity. Somebody with some knowledge said, wow, this is what you need to do. And the interesting thing is, I've been doing that now for about 2 months. I'm a lot stronger. And I actually think that now I could take an Olympic bobsled run and not get hurt. I don't think I'll do it again, just to make sure. But you break through that ceiling of complexity by bringing someone else in. So about 3 years ago, Dr. Shapira and Dr. Amade came to us. They had 3 offices. I won't tell you how many employees.
Okay, well, we started with a lot of employees. For those of you who are out there, Mark and I started with a lot of employees. We had 3 offices. We were going to build an empire. We were on a roll. And we kept producing more income, but we didn't take much more home. Our stress levels were going up. Stop me if I make a mistake, Mark. Along the way, it's like my wife got cancer, and it was like we were dealing with lots of heavy stress. Mark, when we first started building, Mark had no kids. By the time we were at full force, Mark had 5 kids. We had more stress than money, and pretty much we called Bill because we felt like we needed a change in lifestyle. And pretty much since calling Bill, our income has gone up. Probably not as much as we'd like, but it never does. No matter how much we had, it wouldn't be enough. But we cut down about between 20 and 40 work days we cut down to working 180 days a year. We're down to 7 employees. We're definitely making more money than we used to, and we have way more time off. Our staff is happier. The staff we still have, we now have 7 staff members who basically divide up and take about 20% of our total income. And our total income is about the same as it was when we had 29 employees. So not quite as much, but our net is way up from there.
This is Bill Blatchford. My phone dropped the call, and so Ira, I hear you speaking, so pick up the ball where I left it.
So basically our life is great. We have more free time, we're taking more vacations, we're taking more continuing education than ever, and our stress level is way down. What do you think, Mark? Where are you feeling?
You know, I think that all I could do is add a little bit more fluff to it. You know, I think I showed you some numbers just 2 days ago. It's ironic that I didn't even think about this tonight. I had looked at some numbers from 2004. Bill, you'll like this. I think at the time we had generated, we needed to generate almost $1 million more a year to get paid $30,000 less than we're getting paid now, and we're working, like Ira said, probably 40 days less a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, and
let's talk about some of the things that
actually,
you
actually, Bill, right now, let me take just 1 second. I'll publicly say thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What are some of the things? I mean, where did we start? Where did you start? I mean, how did you come to the realization that you needed some help?
I'm gonna tell you, Mark is the one who did it. He pretty much came up to me and said he was beginning to hate dentistry. At that point, we knew we had to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going into work every day and you're not happy, you have to change things.
Yeah. Where did we start? What did you do first? There are several doctors. We have doctors in this call from all over the country. Some of them I've seen on their names on various calls. They're looking for their silver bullet. They're hoping they can find the secret that's going to make it work. And I'll be the first to tell you I don't know of any silver bullets. But where did we start with your practice?
Okay,
what did you have to do first?
We signed up with you. We both spent a couple hours of talking to you to figure out what we wanted out of our life. And we took our whole staff off to one of your dynamos.
How big was your staff?
I think when we went to the Dynamo, we may have been down to 27.
Yeah.
But that was because we had already talked to you, and first thing you told us is anybody who's making your life miserable, get rid of them. And so we started getting rid of people who weren't making our life better, but were actually just adding stress.
Now, that may scare a few people on the call, but one of the things that I'm really committed to with my clients is that life is fun. I don't buy this theory that life has to be difficult. I actually think that life is easy. Life can be fun, and we only get to do this. I don't care what your religious persuasion is. You basically only do it on this planet once, at least in the form we're in today. But it's a very short span that we're on this planet, and I think let's work from the glass being half full instead of empty. And I think anybody that keeps staff members around that don't make your life fun, that don't make your life easy, that aren't contributing to your well-being, then I question why do we do that to ourselves? But it's the same for a lot of things in our practice. So we started out with what kind of lifestyle you wanted. Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, as you started to explore that, what were the important things lifestyle-wise?
Well,
Mark,
I think I had to define within myself what it was that I enjoyed doing. And mm-hmm. I know I enjoyed and loved dentistry a lot. I enjoyed my family a lot. And when I was coming in telling Ira I wasn't enjoying dentistry, something was drastically wrong because it's just such a natural thing for me to do dentistry.
Mm-hmm.
I knew something other than dentistry was making me feel that way.
Yeah.
So I had to define what was causing my dissatisfaction with the profession, and it was all about seeing people that weren't really following our dream.
Mm-hmm.
It was just too hard, and it was kind of out of control. So once I defined that, then you made it easy by saying that, you know, you have to really peg the people that are making you feel the most ill and eliminate them quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And pick up the pieces after you do it.
An interesting thing is the people who you most think you can't live without are usually the ones that you most need to live without.
Mm-hmm.
the people who you feel like you can't possibly live without them. Your office will fall apart. They know everything. They do everything. They run everything. And it's like they tend to be the source of an awful lot of everything problems.
So you had three offices, 25 to 30 employees, and what's the state of your office now? Maybe you covered that while I was off the phone.
We're down to 7 employees. That's between the two of you. That's between the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at hygiene. This is one of the. It took us about a year and a half before we did this with you, and pretty much you showed us that we weren't making money on hygiene. Very disturbing, since up until that point in time, building this big hygiene practice was like where we were going to make money, and we sent our staff to very expensive courses, including LVI courses, so that we could learn for how hygiene was going to make us a lot of money. And once you take one step back and realize it doesn't, then you can reorganize everything. So now instead of having 2.5 hygienists, we have 1 full-time hygienist, and we have 1 part-time hygienist, and we do temporary hygienists as we need them. We never have any openings in hygiene. If somebody calls to cancel the patient, we just had someone call today to cancel a hygiene appointment, and we said, well, we've got an opening in mid-September, and they kept it. They said, well, I can't wait that long. We are 100% booked. When Mark is great. He fills in all my voids. So he likes to look at numbers, and Bill gave him numbers to look at. He started looking at it, and we figured out that we had about 2/3 of a full-time hygiene salary that we were paying for missed appointments.
For some of the doctors on the call, why don't you ask some questions about this? How did we determine that we were losing money in hygiene? Some of you on this call have, I'm sure, are very, very heavily ensconced in this idea that hygiene makes money while you're sitting in your private office reading the paper, or they're making money while you're cutting reps or whatever, and why you need a big hygiene department. And here we did just the opposite, because this year, this partnership, two doctors, are probably going to break $3 million. And they only have one hygienist and a part-time hygienist between the two of them. There must be some questions about that. You'll have to unmute your phone to...
Well, if they have no questions about it, what I'll tell you the nicest thing about it is, if you have 2 or 3 hygienists going and you're trying to get dental work done, running and doing hygiene exams all day makes you crazy.
Yeah.
It's like having less hygienists makes the day just much more calm, much more relaxed, much more enjoyable.
The question always comes up is, well, if you don't see them in hygiene, how are you going to diagnose treatment? Well, the thing we discovered in this practice was 2/3 of one hygienist's schedule wasn't showing up anyway. So the question is, how much dentistry you diagnose when people don't show up? And then how much energy is spent out there trying to fill that 2/3 of that hygienist's schedule doesn't show up? Let's talk a little bit about the nature of your practice now. You each work 4 days a week, if I remember right, or 3.5. You're taking quite a bit of vacation time. You have 7 people between you. I know a lot of the people on this call are curious a little bit about you've added sleep apnea in a pretty big way to your practice, I see. And several of the doctors sent us some email questions about how you've done this. How do you get these people in the door? How do you enroll them in sleep apnea? We have a couple doctors on the call who have actually taken some sleep apnea conferences, but they're just not making it happen in their practice. So what are some of the things that you do in that area, and how does that help grow your practice?
Well, the first thing is, if you do sleep apnea right, it's a natural thing that when you do treat your patients, you send them back to the sleep labs. If you get good results, and if you do everything else right, you're going to get a lot of referrals back, because most of the guys out there really aren't having good results. So by having good results, the second thing that happens is, we do a lot of sleep apnea. And when things got slow in the office, sleep apnea patients typically are baby boomers. They're people getting older. They're people who've paid off their houses, whose kids have graduated college. And not only do they have sleep apnea, but by definition they have TMJ disorders. Their jaws are overclosed. They usually have bruxism issues. And we see a lot of big cosmetic and full mouth cases and implant cases coming out of the sleep problems. out of the sleep disorder patients.
And the two of you kind of divide up treatment. Ira, you do the sleep apnea. Mark does more of the implants and the large restorative cases. Now you're busy enough with your sleep apnea. You refer a lot of these out. But this is a tremendous growth for a practice. And for those of you on listening, it's a concept that we started talking about 3 years ago when everybody wanted to be a cosmetic dentist. And I was on that bandwagon. 15 years ago, becoming a cosmetic dentist in your community, that was a big deal. And it was a drawing card. It was a what we now call a purple cow. We started that seminar using Seth Godin's book, The Purple Cow. And we said, what do we do in a dental practice to make it different? Well, Ira had been doing a sleep apnea on a pretty small time basis for 25 years. But we did a seminar about 2 years ago. We invited some people that had added implants and IV sedation and EMJ work and sleep apnea and a few other things, cosmetic dentures. Some of our doctors who were doing these things, in addition to the cosmetics, and they're both very well trained. They've both been all the way through LVI's courses. They've done other courses. Mark does a lot of implants. Ira's been doing TMJ stuff for years. And very well trained, but we couldn't, it wasn't bringing people in. And so we switched the marketing direction, and it's absolutely amazing what starts to happen. And yet a lot of people are trying to market sleep apnea and not getting a whole lot back. Part of it is the way that you present the sleep apnea to the patients. And then how do you then have them go ahead and do large restorative that the partner does, or if you, for those who are solo practitioners, you would do yourself. But,
Bill, I think part of the transition of doing this is actually, I used to go to a fair amount of seminars all the time since I got out of school, but in the last 3 years, when I go to the seminars, it seems like when there is a return to the office team rather than a big group of people that was just coming to work, they absorb a lot of the true excitement and they make things happen, or they have the time. We have the time as a group to discuss what's really not going to work and why even bother with it and come to a conclusion on it. We set dates for things to happen. Sometimes we get a little weak and we forget the date to say, hey, we need to have something going by this such and such date. Let's review it. But the team allows us to do that, and the time that we have, these gaps that we might have in our schedule, we utilize those as you've instructed us to use them.
How do you... You have seven people. Maybe you said this when I was off the phone, but what are the seven people? What are their positions? And how do you function doing this kind of volume with those? You basically got 1.5 million a piece with 3.5 people a piece.
Actually, it's less stressful and less busy. I mean, the stress is way down and the amount of craziness is down. Even though we have less people, we're doing more big cases. One of the things that happened, though, is when we started working with you and we went into this bonus program, and so right now we're 6 months into this year, and I think we've been averaging all seven of the team members, in addition to their salaries, which are generous, have been getting a $1,400 a month bonus on average. To get a $1,400 a month bonus between seven of them means there's about $10,000 bonus being divided. Mm-hmm. And the way the way you set us up with the bonus plan is we have our BAM, our bare ass minimum we need to make before we get to bonus, and then 20 cents of every dollar over that is divided to the staff so that we never go over 20% staff cost.
Yeah.
Well, once the staff gets that, they basically become 20% owners of the practice, and they don't let stuff pass. They don't let people walk out of the office without getting collected. For years, Mark and I used to write off $100,000, $150,000 in bad debt a year. Now we collect about 105%.
Yeah, I would say.
Almost everything is paid for before the appointment. The only time there's ever receivables is when the doctors break the rules.
I think we had four people.
They yelled at us for that because it's their money. They don't like it.
Okay, so I believe you have 1.5 hygienists.
Actually, we don't count our half hygienist. She comes in 1 or 2 days a week, so we have one full-time hygienist who's part of the bonus system.
Huh?
And then we have the part-time hygienist, and either the part-time hygienist or temps that'll come in when we have scaling. When we need to get somebody in, we can get them in.
Okay. And so then how many assistants do you have?
There's a total of 3 assistants. 2 of them are primarily with me. 1's primarily with Mark. But they're totally a team, so if anybody needs coverage either way, they have it. And then there's 3 people at the front. We split the week up, so Mark works Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then I do the following week. We each get 4-day weekends every other week.
Great.
So it kind of feels a little guilty because you kind of feel like you're perpetually on vacation when every other week you get a 4-day weekend.
Let me explain that a little bit. One of the paradigms that we teach is that in Western civilization, most of us grew up with this work ethic that the vacations were doled out as reward for hard work. Well, we look at it completely differently. We see that vacation time and time off is preparation for productive time. When you go on, and I've studied this in dentists for years, right after vacation, they're the most effective. And they go along for about 6 weeks, and somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks, and their diagnosis per day falls off, the production falls off. And they've gone to what I call the mechanical stage. They're showing up for work, but they're really not creative. They're not really there 100%. And then they actually go into what I call the burnout phase. And then we stay at that, and then we get to that point where you say, where you're saying to yourself or you're saying to your spouse, boy, I really need a vacation. Or you start to, worse yet, start telling to your staff or your team, or the worst possible sin would be to start telling that to your patients. Because no patient wants to hear that their doctor is tired and worn out. I've heard doctors actually saying that sort of thing to patients. But so we see it differently. We see vacations as preparation for productive time. And once you start to see that, all of a sudden the dental office can take off a lot more time. Of course, their staff is all on salary, so they don't mind taking time off because they get paid full amount anyway, and the bonus is based on productivity, not how long you hang around. So the staff gets behind this, and for those of you not on a bonus system, well, I would put one in place immediately, and ours, of course, is capped at, in this particular office, is capped at 20%, and they were way over 35% for staff when we started. Well, it's 15% of the gross going right out the door that now comes home. So get yourself set up on a bonus system.
Bill, your system there for the bonus. I mean, Ira and I had been working together for almost 16 years, and we had gone through probably 10 different, how many bonus systems?
I don't know, 10. We probably had 3 or 4 different consultants put us in different bonus plans, and every bonus plan seemed to have a backside to it that all of a sudden it's like staff would say it's based on the month, so if you're having a bad month, they cancel everything for the month and put it into the next month or something.
Right.
Like the way this plan's set up is every day counts, every hour counts, and it's like there's no, they can't play the game. There's no playing of the bonus system.
And the doctors can't play with it either. Tell us a little bit about, you're doing some marketing, Ira, to get the sleep apnea patients in, and then I'm going to have Mark talk about some of the marketing you folks have done on cosmetics and other dentistry, but what's some of the marketing you're doing on the sleep apnea?
Well, we've done tons of marketing, and with sleep apnea, and I've been doing this for 25 years, and I tried all kinds of marketing, and nothing really ever, if they bring patients in, nothing ever seemed to hit. And I started using a marketing, and I've got a website. Anybody out there who wants to go to it can go to see it. It's www.
Well, tell them now, though. I'll get off the call and they'll go to it. Tell them.
Yeah, I hate CPAP.com, but don't go to it now. Go to it later. And as soon as we started doing marketing that said, I hate CPAP, and because of this, we've trademarked it. That and hate CPAP have both been trademarked, and we've actually set up a marketing program. But as soon as we did it, and a lot of this came out of Bill's stuff, it's like it's an emotional, it hits an emotional appeal to the patients. So people who have sleep apnea, a third of them will use CPAP and they're happy with it. Two-thirds of them won't. Well, we hit upon a marketing that hit upon the two-thirds of the patients that wanted what we had to sell. And the amazing thing is, and when we first started doing it, I mean, our first 4 days, we had, I think it was 239 phone calls in 4 days of radio marketing, which was about eight ads total on WGN radio. And we had 6 lines, which is all that came into our office, lit for hours on end. We had no idea how to handle it. It caught us off guard. And it's kind of been flying ever since. In the last couple months, I had a doctor in Germany who told me she got a patient from Africa and Zambia who came from mine. We're literally passing out hundreds of patients around the country to doctors as we look for people to join our program. And all of it came into, it was an emotional appeal to the patient. Some of the stuff Bill teaches us is 7 questions to ask, and the marketing basically answered some of the questions without ever asking them. The patients who come in, so we, every time I do a new patient sleep consult, we set up an hour. Typical patient we collect about $3,000 on, and we also talk to them about TMJ, we talk to them about cosmetics. We get a lot of new patients into our office from this, and instead of being an expense, it's like instead of doing a no-charge consult or a new patient exam and x-rays, we're getting paid $3,000 to talk to the patient for an hour and sell ourselves.
Tell us a little bit about how you actually get the people to go ahead with the sleep apnea appliance, or any treatment for that matter, that once they're in the office. I know that you've really increased the amount of, I was looking at your lab bill the other day on your profit and loss, and your lab bill is very high, which means you're selling a lot of Crown and Bridge. And that's separate from the sleep apnea stuff. But tell us a little bit about what you've changed since you started to work with us on where your patients really enroll. It sounds like in a very windy spot or something. I'm getting a lot of noise on the phone. Go ahead, Ira.
Okay. Well, the first thing is all of our staff are working with your questions. So by the time we come in and talk to the patients, they're passing them off to me. They're telling me what the patient wants, what they've done, how it's worked. And everybody's paying us 100% up front before we get started. So the receivables aren't there anymore. But it's really a question of, I'm not even sure, because it's been over 3 years, how everything we do is done differently.
Oh, okay.
We're not selling anymore. We're offering solutions, and it used to be we try sell. If you're selling appliances, people are going to say that's a lot of money for a piece of plastic. Mm-hmm. If you sell them their problem, it's a funny thing. I used to go and try to sell people appliances. Now if I start to talk to somebody and they say, gee, that's a lot of money, and I it's real simple. I just tell them, you know what, you can always use CPAP.
Yeah.
And it's like the reason they came into the office is because they responded to an ad that says, I hate CPAP. So they've already answered one question for us. You know, what can we do for you? They want something other than CPAP. How has it worked for you? Well, if they came to my office, CPAP's not working. And if we can give them something that works better, how would they feel about it? And the answer is, are you willing to pay $3,000 to give you something that makes you happy? And if they ask questions about insurance, we tell them it's like insurance may or may not cover, but it's okay because you can always have CPAP. And it's weird. About the third time you tell them they can have CPAP, they pretty much say, I'm here because I don't want CPAP. It's $3,000. Here's my credit card. Here's my financing. They're really ready to go ahead with it.
There's a subtle difference that we teach. For those of you listening in have never listened to us before, so it's very subtle. Actually, it's not even subtle. It's a huge departure from the way we've sold dentistry in the past. In the past, what we've tried to do is we've done an exam, we figure out what's wrong, we figure out how we're going to fix the problem, and then we try and convince the patient by education to go ahead with the treatment. And if they don't go ahead with the treatment, we either try and educate them some more, or we accuse the patient of having their priorities screwed up. And what we've done is we've really shifted the whole program to, you find out how is this patient going to benefit emotionally by having this treatment? You find out what the cost has been so far, how it's affected their life, and you find out what they've tried so far and how's that worked. And see, what Ira's doing by asking these questions is, well, how's the CPAP working? And how did you find out about that you had sleep apnea, and why did you seek treatment in the first place? And you get these people talking about, well, their physician said it was life-threatening, their physician told me about strokes, heart attacks, etc. I knew I had to do something. My spouse had moved to another room at night. You know, they tell you all of these stories, and it's real simple. How's that working for you? Gee, it's not. And what have you tried so far, and how's that working? And have you considered a budget if we can help you? And you just go right through it, and it's so different that we're not trying to educate them about how the appliance works and showing them appliances and, you know, give them a lecture on sleep apnea. It's about finding out what that patient wants. And that's and Mark, you do the same technique. I mean, the same questions in selling your implant cases and your large restorative cases. How do you do that, or how does your staff do that?
Well, it seems...
Hey, Bill, it's team. Staff,
yeah.
And affection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems as if...
I said staff. Thanks.
It seems as if the less you get into the detail of the treatment and the more you get into what they're feeling about themselves and their mouth and what they've actually come there for. They didn't come to visit me because, you know, they like Ark or Stacy or... they come because they have a certain impulse to get to your office, and you only mm-hmm. have a shot to do it, you know, maybe once or twice a year to really get into their head and let them tell you what it is that they want from you. I mean, that's what I'm starting to learn. It took me, we've been working at this 3-4 years now, and I'm just starting to get it in the last year. I'm a slow learner.
Well, I'll tell you, you're
pretty
a good learner.
Pretty much the less Mark talks to the patient and leaves the staff alone,
mm-hmm.
the faster they buy the cases.
Yeah, I see. The more
Mark wanted to educate them to the point they just wanted to escape.
Well, you know, listen, now, we all did.
We
That's
did.
That's how we were taught. And 99% of dentists out there still believe that a large part of their practice is their patient acceptance is patient education.
Yeah.
Now, for those of you on the call that have never heard me speak, don't panic. Education is still part of the treatment.
Yes.
But I will tell you, and I've been saying this for 25 years, education has nothing to do with the presentation.
No.
Nothing.
Education comes along once the treatment is accepted and you're moving on, and you kind of do it as you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then it's well received. But if you bang them with it all at the same time, you know, the first visit, boy, they're just like, you know what, that's not what I'm here for. You're not listening to me. You're not paying attention to me. You just want to tell me what you know, and you're another doctor.
Part of our mantra has always been find out what they want and give it to them. And this is a hard paradigm for people to grasp. It's a hard paradigm for team members to grasp. It's extremely difficult for hygienists to get that it's not about educating these people. I mean, nobody believes they have gum disease. Nobody believes they have all these problems. And it's just really difficult to do it that way. Well, we've got some time left here. I'd like to hear from some of the people that are on the call that have some questions. I don't really know who's on, but I do know that some of you had some questions today. Well, maybe I won't call on people. Why don't we just call on just anybody that has questions to these two doctors? I mean, they're doing some phenomenal things in their practice. This is your opportunity to find out and pick their brain a little bit about what they're doing. What have they changed? I mean, they're operating this practice at, you know, right at 60% overhead, and that includes debt repayment. So they're doing well.
I have a question. This is Lanny Lesser from Huntington Woods, Michigan. How are you doing?
Yes, Lanny, go ahead.
I'm going to ask, I forgot if, whether it's Ira or your partner, who does, let's call it the, who doesn't do the sleep apnea. When they come
Mark
in...
Mark, you're asking.
Okay. So, Mark, when they come in for the consultation, did they see in your normal patient, let's call it, non-sleep apnea, did they see you first for a consultation before they see the hygienist? That's one of my questions.
It depends what they're coming in for. You know, a lot of times the patient, you're talking about people that are non-sleep apnea, right?
Right. I'll call them transactional, normal patients.
Okay.
So they've called your practice and they say, I've just moved to the area and I need my teeth cleaned.
Yeah. And many times we've learned to, you know, make an attempt. I think the team up front knows to make an attempt to get them in for, you know, your complete exam and whatnot. People really just want to get their teeth cleaned, and they want to feel the office out. So, you know, the team knows that if they have to bend the rules a little bit to make the patient happy, get them in, you tell them, you know, we're gonna clean your teeth, we'll polish you up. You may need something more than that, but we're going to do what you want to do for this time and get them in the door. Most patients are compliant, though, on the phone with going through the process, let's call it, you know.
And seeing the doctor first.
Yeah, yeah. Unless, of course, they're calling because it's a direct marketing response to some of the advertising that Ira does, you know, to get people in the door. Ira's kind of like the guy that likes to play with the marketing.
I see.
And, you know, there are some people that are going to be immediate from either a smile makeover type ad or an internet ad that shows smiles. And they've, you know, the first question I ask them is, how far along have you come in your research on this? And that's something Bill taught me, and it works very well because a lot of these patients that are coming in off of the marketing have already gone to two or three offices, and now they just want to feel comfortable with somebody.
Right, and generally they're pretty informed. If they're, do you find that they think of, do you talk about having nicer teeth? How do you feel about your teeth, or how do you feel about your smile? Do you find that we as dentists think, does the patient perceive the notion of their smile, are they down a notch and they're thinking of, how do my teeth look?
Well, I'm going to answer that one because one of the things we started doing with Bill, and it just is amazing, when somebody comes in and they're already interested in cosmetic,
mm-hmm.
I don't talk about teeth, I don't talk about smile. I say, what's coming up in your life?
Exactly.
That you want to be ready for. And if they say, I have a reunion in August, I say, you know, we got to get started quickly if we're going to get you looking great for the reunion. It's like, because
right. So you're getting into their need or their pain, so to speak.
I don't even want to call it need or pain. They have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If their problem is their daughter's getting married and they're worried about the pictures.
Right.
If you don't know what their problem is, how are you ever going to fix it? If you think their problem is teeth, and their problem is they're embarrassed about their daughter's wedding and how
right.
their smile is,
right.
It's like, until you know that, you'll never get it.
Yeah, you're not on the same page.
You're not on the same page. I mean, one of the things that Bill does, which we love him for and hate him for, is everybody in our office is reading books and listening to tapes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So
we're role-playing all the time.
Yes,
we're
role-playing and practicing so much that it becomes second nature.
One of the things that's happening, I can interject here, is that doctors focus on teeth or smiles. It doesn't matter. What you want to do is find out, okay, what's going on in your life that prompted you to pick up that telephone? And I can tell you it's neither teeth or smiles.
Right.
I've got a wedding coming up. My daughter's getting married. And I don't want to look like the grandfather of the bride. I want to look like the father of the bride. Or if that class reunion, you get into the class reunion and find out, you know, high school or college, where are you going for it? I suppose a lot of people are going to be there. Anybody in particular, you get them thinking about the reunion, not about their smile or their teeth.
Right. Or I just got divorced and I'm back on the street. I'm dating again.
Wonderful. I mean, that's exactly the kind of stories you get them telling you about.
I had a patient who spent $60,000 because she was going to see her high school boyfriend at their 50th reunion.
Yeah.
And she hadn't seen him for 50 years.
Yeah. Was she single or married?
She remembered him at 18. He's also 50 years old.
Okay, my second question is, do you spend any time, any more appointments building rapport? Before I come in to see you, and I'm interested I have a reunion coming up. Do you spend about an hour with me, and then do you come up with a case presentation, or do you come up with with two to three options for me at that first appointment, or do you try to maybe have them come back a week later for what I call a complete dental physical, where at that point you take x-rays, you take models, whatever you would need to do, and then at a third appointment, come up with case presentation.
Reunion's coming up here, doctor.
I'm sorry, what?
Coming up in a couple of weeks. We can't fool around here for 3 weeks, or we got to get this done.
Okay, so you come up with the answer at that first visit.
you know, you
I'm going to tell you, there's cases where both Mark and I have done it where somebody's got a short deadline. We take photos, we take impressions, we take x-rays. We have a wax-up done, and a week later, they're already in provisionals.
Right, but I'm saying if they don't have, if there's not, if you've asked the question, is there something coming up, are we on a time schedule, and they say no. I'm talking about just another type of patient.
Are you talking strictly a cosmetic case? Are you talking somebody that needs complete rehabilitation? I mean, there are all so many different variables, you know, that...
Well, let's just talk about let's talk about a cosmetic case. Somebody says, gee, I'd really like to look younger.
Right.
I've had a facelift. Actually, my wife just told me this today. She just went out with somebody. She's had all kinds of plastic surgery, and my wife can never understand, of course. She says she has yellow teeth, and she's 58, and this new friend is 58, and they took some golf lessons together, and she can't understand why, you know, people don't value their teeth as, you know, they go to all kinds of other trouble. So I guess my question to you is, do you find that there's value in presenting it, that the entire answer that at that first consultation, and second question, sub question from that is, do you give options to them?
You haven't even begun with knowing whether they've thought about how much it's going to cost them.
Okay, so then you do...
Well, I think you have to get that going pretty quickly.
So you ask them about, have you considered what your
budget? Have you thought about a budget?
Okay.
Our clients very often ask that question on the phone. So we're talking money sometimes before the patient even gets in the office. And I think this whole concept of waiting until the third appointment, and very often it's the last 5 minutes, the last appointment you ever see the patient when you tell them the fee, and you've just wasted 3 hours of your time and theirs. And it's so much easier to find out what they want, why they want it, what they've considered spending on it, and can we do it? And,
yeah.
You know, how long does it take to answer that question? It takes a few minutes.
Yeah.
And that can be done mostly by staff members, by team members. You don't even have to be involved.
Yeah. I have a patient I just started with, and the team basically tried to discourage this patient because all she did on the phone was tell him how she's already spent so much money with so many dentists and she couldn't afford anything. But she insisted she come in for the consult, so she's going to spend a few hundred dollars coming in and talking. And I told her that the first thing we had to do was a complete neuromuscular workup and an orthotic. So it was $6,500 to start with. We didn't cut any bones because I already knew she said, five times before she came in, she had no money. So we quoted her $6,500 thinking she was going to go away.
Right.
She signed up a $15,000 Capital One credit line because she figured after the TMJ stuff, she was going to need crowns and she may as well get a down payment on it. So we ended up with $15,000 plus the $300 for the consult coming into the office on a patient who said she absolutely positively couldn't afford anything.
Right.
And if you ask me what I did to sell the case,
nothing.
I walked into the room because the team had already sold the case.
I see.
The team had sold the case, and they it's crazy, but they really sold the case, I think, when they told her how much it was going to cost and tried to discourage her by telling her she probably couldn't afford it because of the way she sounded on the phone. And I think that was the thing that may have been the thing that pushed her over to coming in.
Right. Or she says that to every dentist she calls.
Yeah, well, she may say it to every dentist she calls, but we're probably the only one who gave her that response.
No, I understand, right.
And they're doing the case.
But she had a lot of dentistry in her mouth.
Uh-huh.
She had thousands of dollars of dentistry that had been done within the last year or two.
Mark, on one of your, on a rehab patient or a restorative patient, maybe not a great big case, maybe a small smile makeover of some sort, how long would you say you personally spend with the patient prior to them making their decision?
None. I think pretty much when they know they want that, Stacy's already taken care of it, and I just have to kind of go confirm it all.
Uh-huh.
She's already. I think that's what you're asking?
Yes.
Yeah, because she's already gone through, you know, if they're really a smile consult, they've already been kind of assessed on the phone, like you've said, and by the time they get here, now they're seeing our office. I mean, we've got a very nicely appointed office, and we did that after we got going with you also. We have some beautiful smiles that are up on the walls that we have done. We had a photo shoot for all those smiles, and then we asked patients if it would be okay if we displayed them. So when they walk in the office, they get a feel that this is a place to be if you want to fix your smile. So I think all of those factors, the marketing, the feel that you get when you walk into the practice, the feel they get when they see the greeting from the team, the consult room, sitting down with, you know, Stacy, who's my you know, key assistant, and then walking back to the chair, you know, they get a little tour of the office, and then Stacy gives me a little briefing. And if I don't go in there and try to blow it by all technical with them, the case is usually pretty much in the bag at that point, or it's not, and I know not to waste my time. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah. No, that helps.
I was the worst at it. I would get way into...
Yeah, margins and
just
type of porcelain and...
Everything.
We all do that because we're technophiles.
Yeah.
But you see, that's what we have to get away from, and that's the biggest part of coaching is that it took me 2 years to get Mark passed.
Yeah.
I don't expect to get somebody passed on the phone call because you've all heard this before, but it took 2 years, and Ira got past it pretty quickly, but Mark was doing this for a good 2 years. He said, but Bill, I got to tell them what I'm going to do. I said, they don't care.
No, they don't.
They don't care. Now, we do inform consent after the case is accepted, but it's
right.
Not part of the sales presentation.
Now,
and
what you should know is Mark has the world's best hands. Everything he does is perfect. He's just got magic hands. He was born with them.
Thank you, Ira.
It's like, and he can't stand anything less than total perfection.
Yeah, I think
it's like, and he's so into perfection. It was really hard for him to give up explaining how he was going to make everything perfect.
Yeah. Nice stuff. Mark, you've done a lot of work with the numbers since we work. What would you say the keys to keeping your overhead under control, keeping, what numbers do you look at? What have you learned working with us to really pay attention to? Because, you know, you've got your overhead in pretty good shape this year.
Yeah, it's doing a lot better than it has in the past. I think that, you know, I know we don't, I used to complain about not having, let's say, this or that, the money to do this, the money to... So I don't necessarily complain about it anymore. Now I kind of draw the team into it with me.
Mm-hmm.
And ask them for help on it. So if I'm having a slow month and we're having a little trouble getting paid on some of the debt load that we have, you know, they know that in
mm-hmm.
a positive way, and they start looking at stuff. You know, they start looking at supplies. We did a whole revamping back in January. I mean, you'd be amazed what you find in your cabinets. I mean, everybody that's on this call, if you take the time to look,
yeah,
be amazed what you find. I mean, and that's just a minimal thing, but I think just keying in on staff and marketing, watching where the dollars go on the marketing, what the return is, so we're real careful about watching, you know, whether we're getting some benefit out of it. We used to continue to do the same marketing in hopes that it would bring a different result, and I think what we've learned that if after one or two times of doing something, you're not getting an immediate response, change its position, find a different place. So that's...
I apologize for the ferry boat behind me.
What's that?
I apologize for the ferry boat horn.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
What do you consider on any, and it might be different on different types of marketing, but let's say something in a newspaper. What do you consider a proper return on investment?
Well, they
and how long will you go with that ad, so to speak, to find out?
Well, you know, sometimes you put an ad in the paper and you don't even get one call on it. Well, don't do it again. Put it in a different spot. Change the ad. Do something different with it and find out what works. Now, Ira's found, between he and I, we found that some things work and some don't.
Right.
You know, obviously, but you have to respond quickly to not, you know, it's easy to just throw something in a newspaper for 12 months and you have a revolving where they put it in all the time for you. And if you're not tracking it, I mean, tracking is very important.
No, that I understand, which is why I'm asking that question. In other words, do you have a certain threshold above or below which your analysis is this is working or this isn't? Return on investment, a dollar amount.
Okay, Mark actually has charts and charts and charts of all this stuff. So we look at it as we go and do things. But I will tell you, we made some huge mistakes because we decided we were going to do lots and lots and lots of cosmetic dentistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent an ungodly amount of money doing cosmetic dentistry ads. And we signed a year contract for Chicago, for North Shore Magazine, which is high-end Chicago. And we did full-page ads for a full year. We didn't produce enough dentistry to pay for the ads.
Yeah. We have one of those in Detroit called Our Magazine, which is like $6,000 a page.
One of the things that they do is Mark keeps an Excel spreadsheet of dollars of treatment accepted on each media they do. Now, you keep those ads, those Excel spreadsheet for a year, you take a look at it. If you're going to spend a dollar in advertising, you need to get at least three just to break even, because the dentistry is not free, too. Part of it is learning the numbers to watch for and paying attention to it and studying it. And they've hired some outside marketing firms to work with, and they've really worked at it. But it's not just going out there and going on some forum and somebody saying, Lossy Magazine's worked or newspapers work, let's do a newspaper ad, or radio worked in my town, because everybody tries in radio. You've got to study what's going on demographically in your area before you start spending money.
Well, that I understand.
And the other thing is that with marketing the cosmetics, we found that in Chicago there were so many doctors marketing cosmetics. What are you going to do to make your practice different, marketing cosmetics? And the answer is you can't.
Right, you have to find another niche.
Find something else.
The best niche I found for marketing cosmetics was treating sleep apnea, because the patients who came in for sleep apnea treatment were the right demographic for cosmetic dentistry.
Yeah.
So what happened is you got all these people who are coming in who are good candidates.
Right. Yeah, that I understood from what you said before.
Well, any other questions? We have time for one more question from the audience. Anybody else? Question for either Mark or Ira?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Daryl in California. I noticed their Sleep Group Solutions and the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine. Are you affiliated with either one? Could you comment on either one?
I'm a diplomat of the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine. I was a founding member of the Sleep Disorder Dental Society 17 years ago that became that. As far as I'm concerned, that's probably the best group out there as far as science and connections. There's a group called Dental Organization of Sleep Apnea that I am a founding member of. But if you're going to join one organization involved in sleep, I'd tell you to go to the Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine. I teach a course. There's lots of people teaching courses. With all this stuff, what's most important is that you understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. There's a tendency sometimes, and this is one of my problems with DOSA, it's like to figure out all the different ways you can charge patients.
Mm-hmm.
It really works better if you know what you're doing, why you're doing it, what you expect to get out of it, and get the bad results. Nothing does as well as getting the great results.
Are you affiliated with a medical?
I work with several. I'm a consultant at about 9, maybe 10 different sleep centers, and I'm in the process right now of opening something called Chicago Dental and Sleep Associates, Sleep Associates.
Wow.
And I'm going to be in different sleep labs, and I'm training either myself or doctors who are taking my course are going to go in and actually work in the sleep lab, seeing the patients and getting direct referrals, because basically what I want to do is teach the sleep clinics how to make more money. If they make more money by working with me, I am their best friend. That's something I learned.
Well, you've been doing sleep apnea for 25 years. Why did it take off in the last couple of years?
Yeah. A lot of it's because talking to Bill, I've changed what I've done. Marketing, I've changed what I've done. But there's also been a change in the environment. I was an assistant professor at the medical school in the 80s doing research, but part of the reason I was there, I was the only one in the state of Illinois doing it. And if you're the only one doing something, people tend to throw rocks.
Yeah.
Right now, sleep apnea, treatment of sleep apnea is a treatment whose time has come. And part of that's because we've been accepted by the Academy of Sleep Medicine. But I think the real big thing that's happening with it is that the demographics of the population, the baby boomers coming of age, and baby boomers don't want to be hooked up to a CPAP machine with a hose and a mask. So there is a demographic explosion of patients right now.
Yeah.
And because of that, if you're in the, you know, sometimes people say you're lucky, but luck comes because you're in the right place at the right time, and you're in the right place at the right time because you've been looking for that place, and a lot of times you've been in the right place for a long time, and things caught up.
And well, I want to thank you for being on this call. And for those of you doctors listening in, if you're interested in how we've instituted these changes to Mark and Ira's practice over the years to make them more profitable and give them more time off, one of our representatives will call you once. And please return the call, whether you're interested or not. If you're interested, great. If you're not interested, just say so. And we won't bug you. We don't do that. We sell our program the same way we teach Ira and Mark to sell dentistry. It's you're probably right. Some of you can't afford it, and it's amazing what happens. We just find out what you want if we can help you. But it's more about creating a lifestyle first, and then designing a practice to support that lifestyle. And that's to us a lot more important than how much money you're making or how many in your cases you get to do it. Does it support your lifestyle? And I think that's the question you should be asking yourself.
That was meant to be.
How would I improve my life? If I had more time off, what would I do? If I had 8 weeks vacation a year, what would I do with my family? I mean, where are the places we'd like to go? If I could write down an income number that I'd like to produce in that 3.5 or 4 day week, would that number be, would that number be? How much more could you fund a pension plan? That sort of thing. So thank you very much, Ira.
One last thing you didn't add, Bill.
Yes.
Am I having fun?
Yeah, are you?
Yeah, I'm having a great time. How about you, Mark?
How about Mark? Is he having fun in dentistry again?
I think he hung up on you. He is. Nothing but the left.
Yeah. All right, so thank you very much for everybody being on the call, and have a great month of August.
Thank you.